Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Legal Wolf podcast. My name is Krista Lynn. I am your guest host for this series called The Struggle is Real, where we are normalizing conversations about struggle for lawyers within our profession. We are so often taught and encouraged to either put on our best face, pretend like there's no emotions, pretend like there's no struggle, definitely don't talk about it on social media. And this series is in conjunction with Steve Lawler of the Legal Wolf podcast, intended just to talk about the fact that us lawyers are in fact humans. And so today I have a guest with me by the name of Chris Osborne, and I'll let him introduce himself. Chris, thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Chris. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure to get to know you recently. I'm Chris Osborne, and I wear a few different hats. I'm always trying to figure out which hats I'm supposed to wear and which ones maybe I don't need to wear for a while. But I have a small law firm in Charlotte called Osborne Conflict Resolution, where I mainly do collaborative law approaches and mediation. Collaborative family law is kind of what got started as a way to help people with disputes stay out of court. And it's basically like hiring two mediators, just one works for each side. And so that's what I've been doing for about 4 or 5 years. But then for about the past 10 years, I've also been one of the co-founders of a company called Real Time Creative Learning Experiences. We started off as Real Time CLE, and what we've been doing is basically presenting workshops it looks like they're on ethics and professionalism, but kind of spoiler alert, and since we're kind of amongst kindred spirits here, we've always been from the day one kind of smuggling in well-being type topics, well-being type concepts. It might be under the guise of what looks like a program on ethics, but really we like to focus on not so much parsing the rules, but we like to talk about ethical decision-making and what is it, what are the factors that can have an impact on people when they are facing ethical dilemmas. It's not just, you know, oh, I know the rule is this, so I guess I should do the right thing. What is it that makes us who are, you know, we are lawyers and we know the rules, we know the ethics obligations we have, but what makes people forget or not care as much or not, you know, jump through the hoops that they need to and just kind of go with the flow of something, maybe responding out of stress or responding out of some other sorts of forces that they feel like are working on them. So we've used movies as a means of ginning up discussion, and we try to get people interacting. But really, what I'm excited about being on this podcast for especially is because we've been trying to make it safe for lawyers to have a conversation about well-being and about how they're doing and be honest about it. If somebody comes into a workshop and wants to say, I've got everything going great, my practice is awesome, be like me, I'm like, get out of here. I don't want to hear from you. That I can't relate to that. And most people can't relate to that. So that's been a lot of fun. So I come at these things both as kind of a teacher and instructor. I was a law professor for a while, but also come at them as somebody who's practiced in a number of different settings and had to, you know, try to navigate my own challenges as I'm trying to, navigate a practice and family responsibilities, outside responsibilities, like people have. And so this kind of topic is a delight to talk about, and looking forward to it.
Yeah, you know, I have so many questions just from your introduction alone, but I'm going to start with a softball.
Sure.
You said real time, was it creative learning experience? Was that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so I can't help but notice that creative learning experience also has the same letters as continuing legal education. And tell me that
exactly.
Is okay.
that was very much intentional. We started off as real-time CLE because all we were doing was continuing legal education. And a few years, well, it was probably about in 2016 or 17, I think, is when we started thinking about, you know, number one, what we're talking about, ethical decision making and the pressures and things that are that people are dealing with when they're making decisions, probably has some application outside the legal world. And so we've actually done presentations for a big pharma type company, for mental health therapists and hospital type workers. We did a presentation for courthouse personnel, nurses, jailers, and you know, like trustees, people who are in charge of the people awaiting pretrial detainees, awaiting trial. We had a very wide audience that particular day, but our content really is helpful to other people besides lawyers. And so what we realized is really we've had some opportunities to speak outside the legal realm, and we love doing that when we can, working with companies and things, but we also work with law firms. And what we realized too is everybody's sort of pigeonholing us and saying, or thinking that we're just about, you know, playing movies and talking about movie clips in our programs. But what we realized is we have other kinds of things we do, like you know, stand-up activities, kind of games, polls, anything to get people in the room engaged with the content. And so we're like, wait, creative learning experiences, that's CLE. It's sort of the same thing. So we can still, you know, be in the CLE world, but expand broader as well. And so, yeah, we did do that on purpose.
I really love that, not just in the creativity of the naming, but in the fact that what you said, like you realize that your content actually has a reach outside of the legal profession. And I love that because it reminds us that, hey, lawyers are like other people.
Yes. Well, that's been one of our interesting tensions the whole time. You know, my partner in the organization in real time is Michael Kahn, and he was a lawyer for 6 years, but he decided the law was not for him. Went back to school and got a degree as a mental health counselor. But as he started practicing as a counselor, he still had that connection to the law of having practice, and he stayed involved with lawyer groups. And that's how he and I met. We were both on the Mecklenburg County Bar here in Charlotte. We were on a committee that was formed to help lawyers deal with stress and pursue well-being proactively, not just crisis response. And so that's part of the message is, hey, you know, we may think we're some special kind of animal or something, but we're not in the sense that we operate like other people. We actually have limits. We're finite. We need sleep. We need, you know, to take care of ourselves. And it's easy in any helping profession to lose sight of that. And so a lot of our message has been to humanize lawyers and to say, look, don't buy into the lie that you're just supposed to be this hour billing machine automaton and just keep cranking it out and never stop to, you know, recharge somehow, you know, and different people recharge different ways. One of the challenges we have occasionally in getting, we usually can get mandatory CLE credit in most jurisdictions, but occasionally a jurisdiction is a little bit more skeptical or scrutinizing. And sometimes their criticism is, well, you're saying things that lots of people could benefit from, not just lawyers. And we're like, yes, that's right. We know that, but lawyers need this. And we're going to be talking to them as lawyers and talking to them about how it applies in their life as lawyers. Right. So we're not just coming in saying, hey, it's good to think about mindfulness and explore what that is. We're trying to say, look, if you are a lawyer and you've got a litigation practice, what would it look like to have a pause here and there where you stop and think about what you're doing and why you're doing it instead of staying just sort of on the reactivity treadmill all day long? So it's interesting that you say that.
Circular logic and most completely lawyer legal profession argument I've ever heard. Yes, lawyers are humans. We're so glad that you're offering this class for them. But by the way, because lawyers are humans, we can't teach this to them because they're just like everybody else. And we don't want lawyers to think that or.
Yeah, you can't come tell them something. You can't. Yeah, they say you can't come tell them something that you could tell anybody else. And I'm like, that just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. The whole point is we as lawyers don't, at least in our culture, and it's different in different types of practice settings, different geographies, things like that. But we don't typically think of ourselves as ordinary humans. And, right. And even if we do, sometimes our clients don't think of us as ordinary humans. They sort of kind of put the expectation out there. That's one of the tensions that we talk about. Our clients have these demands and expectations. And some of them are, you know, really vocal if we don't meet them. And it's very challenging. There's a cost sometimes to telling a client, you know what, I'm not going to be able to do that for you on that timetable because I have other things going on. We would tend to say, yeah, sure, I'll do that too. Sure, I'll do that too. But you're saying that to about 10 or 20 different people. When are you going to get it all done?
Right. So, you know, this is, I'm thinking of a cultural cross-reference right now. It's August 4th today in the afternoon when we're recording this. I'm not sure exactly when this episode will come out, but just for the audience's benefit, we are near the end of the Summer Olympics in Tokyo. And obviously a big point of discussion has been Simone Biles and her decision to, one, take a mental health pause on her competition from the Olympics because of so much pressure that she has been facing because of, you know, after effects from being the last survivor of the Larry Nassar scandal that is still competing. And then, of course, the physical and safety concerns around, you know, the actual competition the realm that she competes in and how
exactly
dangerous it can be to not have your body and mind in complete alignment. So obviously there has been widespread acclaim and criticism in her decision to care for herself and really not risk her life in competing in several events.
Yes.
The equivalent of that for lawyers, right? Like what is, you mentioned, you know, okay, in a litigation practice, what would taking a pause look like? So help me in using that kind of reference point, like what does that look like for lawyers? I think we talk about, okay, we need to take time to engage in self-care and to pause, but how does that actually work in our profession? How do lawyers find time, not just when they're burnt out, but before getting to that point to take care of themselves?
That's a great question, especially that question about how to do it before we're at the point of burnout. We like to talk about trying to pay attention to our bodies, you know, which is kind of also a radical thing. I bet you probably got through all of law school without everybody ever hearing the words, hey, pay attention to your physiological reactions to things. You know, we don't think that way. We are trained to kind of analyze and think up in our heads. And so it kind of begins with paying attention to, and a lot of what we try to get people to do is pay attention to, how do you know when stress is getting to you? And stress is usually kind of the entry point. We ask every audience, you know, even when we travel somewhere, especially beautiful, like we've been to Australia and the scenery is different and the culture is different. And we ask, you know, have you all figured out how to have a stress-free practice? Is that possible? And everybody laughs because it's not anywhere, because think about it. We deal with people. We deal with the government. We deal with computers. We deal with a court system. What are the chances something will go wrong, you know, with all those things? And so we're going to have stress. That is a given. The question is, can we monitor? And some stress is good. That's the other thing. It's good to have deadlines. It's good to have, you know, game time. It's good to have show time. It's good to have your hearing set on or a trial because you know what to do. You're on and your body's responding. Stress is actually the body's response to changes in stimuli. And you don't want to lose that. That's really good. The problem is, do we ever pause and monitor, am I at a level of stress, either spiking, you know, hyper-stress in a particular circumstance or instance where we kind of might describe it as being jacked up or really dysregulated or, you know, we might call it frustrated, angry, testy, whatever. Or the other possibility is, are we at a chronic level where we're maybe not at a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10 all the time, but we're always at a 7 or above? Either of those things, you know, it messes with us physiologically and it messes with us in cognitively, and we don't make as good decisions. And so there's a point beyond which stress becomes problematic in the excess. There was a survey they did in North Carolina probably about 10 years ago where they asked lawyers to respond, have there been times when you have worked beyond a level of stress that you knew was productive and you got into that unproductive danger zone? And like 50% of the people said, absolutely, yes, it's a real thing. And so it starts with, you know, what are the little things? What do you notice or what does somebody else notice about when you're doing too much or you're feeling too much or you're not handling it well? And because a lot of times you may not stop to be aware of it, but the people around you are like, whoa, like got to give him a wide berth today. He's in, you know, he's in a mood or she's, you know, snippy or whatever. So personality sort of changes. I'm a pretty nice, mild-mannered guy. You don't know me very well, Krista, but, you know, in our phone conversation, you can see me on camera. But, you know, it's kind of like the Hulk used to say, you wouldn't like me when I'm angry, you know. So looking at the things that make us mad, that get us reactive, is a good starting place. And looking at the things, you know, just asking the question, you know, when's the last time I ate a healthy meal versus am I eating takeout at my desk, you know, 5 times a week and into the night? And so it starts really with being willing to ask the question. And if we're brave, being willing to ask somebody else, if you have a spouse or significant other or kids, saying, hey, can you tell a difference between when I am stressed and not stressed? And if so, what do you notice? That takes a lot of courage, but you can learn a lot of good feedback in that.
Yeah, I find that self-awareness is in many areas something that lawyers are very good at, you know, but in other ways, we really miss the mark. We might be super self-aware of how we are coming across in tone and in execution in a negotiation, or, you know, in our performance in a courtroom, but less self-aware when it comes to things that keep us healthy mentally, physically, physiologically, whatnot. I think what you said about, you know, just taking an inventory of your physiological reactions is something that we just don't know how to do very well.
Yeah.
And you mentioned something, you know, a few minutes ago about, you know, our profession and not just being that of crisis response. I find that, you know, when I go through it, like the catalog, I'm here in Florida, in the United States, and the catalog of CLEs that are offered in the ethics space generally fall under like mindfulness for lawyers and things like that, that generally bring you to a greater sense of self-awareness. But it's so often more like, okay, well, here's what to do when, you know, you discover that your colleague is an alcoholic. It's affecting their work product.
Right,
which is when
right.
It's too late, right? Like, we don't teach healthiness. It's kind of like the medical system, and not to go into a completely different diatribe, but like our system of, you know, medical care, at least in the United States, is designed to respond to people when they get sick instead of focus on keeping people healthy. And I find our profession to be
yes.
the same.
I think our profession is very much that way. And that's the approach that we've taken since we started doing these programs back in 2007 was our very first one for the Mecklenburg County Bar. We started going on the road in because we got a lot of great feedback and people really responded to the programs really well. And so we started traveling, going to other states in about 2010, 2011. And that's been one of the approaches we've taken from the start. We don't want to be just on the side of doom and gloom and saying, you better pay attention to your well-being or else you're going to be depressed or alcoholic or look at all the terrible statistics and all that, because it's kind of a, you know, it's a buzzkill. It's not a positive message, but also it doesn't really get you far. Like, knowing more in your mind, knowing more statistics, having some cognitive recognition that, oh, I'm at risk for blah, 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 blah. It's not going to help in the moment when you're trying to make decisions about whether and how you need to care for yourself. We think you need to be, you know, dealing with your desire, your will. Most lawyers that we talk to and hear from would say, I know I need to maybe go for a walk or exercise. I know I need to stop working at a certain time and let my brain rest. I know I need, but so cognition is not the problem. Awareness that they should make a change isn't usually the problem, but the ability and the encouragement, the will to do something, to say, so that means tomorrow I'm going to turn my phone off. Mm-hmm. As soon as you start having a thought like that, depending on where you work and what the environment is, you might be thinking about, oh my gosh, but I'm going to catch so much hell from X, Y, and Z, or I won't be able to do this. There's so many ways that we get, you know, just an onslaught of reasons not to prioritize ourselves out of fear, out of worry, out of, hey, I got to, out of desire to do the job well. And so we've tried to take a positive approach from the very beginning, saying, look, think of it this way. If you are a law firm, that's one way to look at it. You know, if you were a manufacturing facility and you have a bunch of textile machinery that is, you know, cranking out textile fabric day in, day out, you can't run that company without oiling and lubricating and tuning the machines and making sure their software is working, their hardware is working. And you've got to do preventative maintenance, and you've got to, of course, you know, you want to prevent a breakdown because it's going to cost you absolutely way more money. Well, in a law firm, there is no physical machinery like a, you know, there's computers, copiers, things like that, but they're not the main engine of what a law firm does. It's the brain power and the capacity of all the people working there. And so you got to do preventative maintenance on the people. That's your engine. And if lawyers can't function at their best, it's bad for the client service. It's bad for productivity. In addition to being, it's bad for them. Same thing if you're in a small firm or it's just a solo or a smaller different organization that's not, you're still the engine. If you're a lawyer, you got to have your brain, you got to have energy to practice, and you got to take care of that stuff. And so we like to tell people, you know, like they tell you in the airplane, put your oxygen mask on first. You're not good to anybody else unless you're caring for yourself. The challenge has been, it's hard, I think, for lawyers to admit weakness, to admit struggle, which is why I love, you know, the stuff that you're involved with and that the Legal Wolf podcast is involved with, because, you know, the struggle is real, and COVID kind of brought that home, I think, to everybody, that we do have to pay attention to these things. And if you thought you had everything rocking about, you know, 16, 18 months ago, you know, everybody got thrown these curveballs.
Right.
And so bottom line is we try to take a positive approach and say, look at this as something that's good for your practice, good for you. It might improve your relationships if you pay attention to some of these things, because a lot of us, where our stress shows up is we're jacked up from something that's going on at the office. We don't know what to do with it. We don't pause to do anything with it, but we go home and we're still kind of ruminating on it or working on it. It's working on us in our head. And we might either go home and just, you know, want to shut ourselves away and sort of check out and not engage with our families, or we might come in with a little too much energy and too much, you know, I got the heck beat out of me at the office today. And we might, you know, bring too much of that energy home and kind of be ordering people around and telling them what to do, which might not be our ordinary style. So the positive approach, I think, is super helpful. And the way to hopefully reach people's, you know, hearts, not just minds.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also very relatable, like that proactive, positive approach is necessary and relatable. Do you talk about like personal struggles, personal stories in your education that you do? And if so, I mean, the point of this series is to let other lawyers know that whatever it is they're facing, yes, and we generally call it in the mental health space, but it's really beyond that. We're not just talking about DSM diagnosed conditions. We're talking about postpartum,
absolutely,
anxiety and depression, or, you know, interpersonal relationships that are difficult, or, you know, an asshole partner,
yes,
that you have to work with and respond to. So can tell me about how you engage that in your education,
yeah,
and if you would share some struggle or struggles that you have. And I'm sure, you know, wearing all those hats is just part of it.
Yes, I'll be glad to. And I smile, kind of, you know, the podcast listeners won't see it, but I smile because, you know, you would think, oh, the people who go around talking about, you know, mental health and well-being and all, and they must be the folks who have it all together. And that's so laughable. It cracks me up. I find that, you know, we're all, number one, we're better coaches than players. It's easier to tell other people what's going on with them and give them great advice than to actually implement it yourself. And so we've never reached this, neither Michael nor I has reached any plateau. We're like, you know, we know everything we're telling the people out there to do. We are constantly our own object lessons. We are constantly, you know, running into something else. And once you sort of get, you get a rhythm and you think you have things figured out, then life throws you a curveball. And I love all the different things you mentioned, Krista, that could be a curveball where you think you've got everything kind of going on great. But if you have a partner that is struggling or something's going on different, you know, relational dynamics, there's all kinds of things that can affect us. And what we try to talk about is, look, isn't that everybody's reality? And so we don't come in there and say, you all, please tell us your deepest, darkest secrets. Thank you very much. The only way we can get people to feel safe talking about and sharing those things is to talk about them ourselves and to say, and look, this isn't just me 5 years ago. Once I was terrible, but now everything's great. It's like, this is something I learned. And then 2 days later, or 2 days ago, if you saw me, you wouldn't have known I knew that concept at all, because, you know, I tripped, I stumbled, I fell. So I'm glad to do that here. My particular journey as a lawyer has been affected. The most kind of glaring thing, and that maybe a lot of people would recognize and relate to, is I was diagnosed as an adult with attention deficit disorder, not the hyperactivity type. I was never like a hyper kid or, you know, getting hyped up or anything like that, but rather the hypoactive or underactive type, meaning basically my attention was almost always somewhere else other than where I was. And I didn't think anything of this. I didn't think I had any issue or anything like that. And what the psychiatrist I worked with actually helped me see, because what I did recognize was I was always procrastinating. I needed to have a deadline. I needed to have an absolute something be on fire to get motivated to work on it. The absolute worst days for me as a lawyer were coming into the office and there wasn't a brief due or a hearing or something critical right then. I would sort of stumble and sort of spin my wheels, and I struggled to do the mundane things like keeping up with my calendar, keeping up with my billing, a lot of things that just the, you know, that weren't exciting, they weren't interesting. And I happened to talk to a colleague at the law firm I was at the time who had just been diagnosed with ADD and said, hey, actually, this might be you too, because both of us were kind of the same. We were not the people that you wanted to come to keep up with deadlines. We had to have a really good secretary to do that. Mm-hmm. And so what the psychiatrist helped me see was that I had always had this. You don't get ADD as an adult. It's not like adult onset. Typically, it's you've always had it. But you have different people have different coping strategies and mechanisms. For me, I know I caffeinated my way through college and high school and college. And I was smart enough that I could my 11th hour work, my last minute procrastination, pull it out of my butt was good enough to get A's. And so I was like, you know, high school valedictorian, and I went to school on a scholarship and all this. And so I was succeeding academically. Nobody's thinking, oh, that guy might be struggling. And in a sense, they're right, because my coping strategies work. The problem was, once I got through law school and started practicing, and then I had a family and I had more things to keep up with, the coping strategies did not work. And I couldn't keep letting things go to the last minute. There were too many deadlines, too many people counting on me from different directions. Now you got kids, a family that you want to be engaged with, and you got all this work to get done. And it's sort of like, you know, basically you could build yourself, if you wanted to go rafting down a river, you could build yourself a little raft or dinghy from some wood you find in a yard and kind of, you know, wrap it up with duct tape and tie it together. And you'll get a ways down the river, particularly if there's a current. But eventually, if you run into some bigger seas and stuff, that sucker is going to break apart. You need to have a more seaworthy vessel. And I realized that I was not a seaworthy vessel, and that this procrastination, chronic procrastination and disorganization and chaos was not manageable anymore. And so I got treatment for that, medication. I wondered why no new tool of task management or time management, no tool would work for me because of the attention problem. In fact, my psychiatrist said too, she said, we should probably call this adrenaline deficit disorder. This is what the problem is. You don't get enough energy or adrenaline for the mundane. And the way she busted me mainly was, you know, when you were in school, college or high school particularly, what were you doing during class? Were you paying attention to the lecture? I was like, usually no, unless there's a really good professor. What were you doing? Well, I was reading a book of my own. I was doing somebody's Rubik's Cube for them. That dates me a little bit to the, you know, going to school in the 80s. Or I was doing my homework for the next class that I hadn't done yet. So I was always somewhere else. And so that was a big deal for me to figure out, because that was affecting how I showed up as a lawyer, is affecting how I showed up in my home as well. The other struggle that I would say I definitely identify with is I also realized that I had some relational issues. I discovered I'm a recovering codependent, in that because of the way I grew up, my parents divorced and I was sort of, we went with my mom from age 10 on. I was kind of quote unquote the man of the house and very responsive to her needs. And there probably, I can say in looking back, there was probably some unhealthy enmeshment in it, not in a physical sense, but just of, I felt an overwhelming sense of responsibility to take care of her from a young age, and then to take care of everybody sort of around me. And I became kind of, you know, what I would call a people pleaser. And I don't mean that's a good term. I mean, I'm trying to keep everybody happy around me. I'm not really doing it for them. I'm doing it for my sake, because I can't be okay if people aren't okay, is what that means. Basically, if you hear people say I'm a people pleaser and they think that's a good thing, that's not how I use that word. And so I basically, when my marriage, about 13 years in, we had three kids by that point, we had gotten the house that we wanted. I was a partner in a law firm. You'd think things were smoking along, but we were hanging on by a thread, and our conflict was getting really, there was some really difficult conflict there. And it had to do with some of these dynamics of how we related to each other. And so I, around then, started some counseling work on how to sort of have a self and how to recover from being in let me take care of everybody else mode all the time, which really isn't, it's not a noble thing. It's not a good thing. And I was sucking at it anyway. It was writing a lot of checks my ass couldn't cash, let's say, with my mouth. And so that's been a journey of recovery, of trying to figure out, you know, how do I relate in a different way to my wife, to my kids, to the people around me, to my mom when she was then living, and my mother had a long battle with cancer during the midst of this that we were trying to care for her. So I could go on, but I don't want to go on forever. But it's been a lot of stuff that I could, I couldn't pretend that I was just some, you know, when I get to the office and I'm Chris the lawyer and none of that stuff comes in. It just doesn't work that way. I'm the same person. I might have a different focus, but even like a struggle for me was to say to my home, to my family, hey, you know what? This is an important thing that we have going on, but I can't engage with it now because I've got a summary judgment motion. I've got a brief. I've got to focus on my work right now. And for that to be okay, I felt more, I wasn't really as much a workaholic as I was more beholden probably to home and didn't know when to set boundaries to say, you know what, I've got to be able to focus at work and not get pulled into a conflict or some kind of drama or something. And my mom and my wife did a lot of, had to do a lot of kind of recovery work as well. And we've been married now 27 years. Thank goodness. You know, we both were able to get help because that was a dynamic that we both had going on. So those are the two struggles that I relate to most strongly, I would say.
You know, I'm so glad that you talked about both of these things. I can't imagine how many people relate to each of them. And I know that we've chatted a few times, but have not been able to go in depth, you know, in our respective histories. But just starting with your second point on the recovering codependent, I write a lot about codependency. I talk a lot about codependency and my journey with codependency being in an abusive marriage and kind of dealing with all of the after effects of that and really the current effects of it when I was at a very high pressure, high stress, high impact position and, you know, and point in my career. And so that's something that I think as, you noted, at least it's true for me as well, that the people-pleasing aspect of my personality is not a good thing either. It's more, I don't want anybody mad at me. I want everybody to be happy. I have to take care of everyone.
Right.
I find it my job to fix things, fix people. And I think that codependency is something that lawyers can, you know, stand to have a lot more education about how it affects us in our profession, both those kind of codependents that are, you know, like caretakers, like, you know, like you and I, and rescuers as well that have to save others from the consequences of their own actions. So I think that that education that you just gave and just sharing that, you know, will be really eye-opening for a lot of people because at least in my journey, I didn't know what codependency was. I could tell you about it, but I didn't know the word for it. When I finally started learning about it in my journey and my, you know, recovery as well, it really helped me to have a name for it. So I hope that, you know, somebody could hear what you described and a little bit of what I said and be like, oh, that might be something that, you know, is affecting me. It's not a mental health condition, right? It's not a diagnosis that you have, but it's a very real struggle. And so I really appreciate you sharing that.
And it shows up a lot in, you know, I'm also an adult child of alcoholics, or an alcoholic. That is a factor. It's not the only way to get there. But I think one point I wanted to make real quick before you get another topic is, you know, some of the skills that you people like you and I learned in caring for other people and trying to put their needs first. The crazy part is some of that's good. Some of that makes us better, more responsive lawyers. We have a moment in a lot of our workshops at Real Time where we put on the screen, what are the lawyer traits? What are the traits of typical lawyers? Not everybody, but what are typical sort of associated traits with lawyers that make us more vulnerable to anxiety, depression, not even, you know, diagnosable depression, but just, you know, mental health fluctuations, whatever. And we put up things like being perfectionistic, being uptight, problem solvers, all that stuff. And one person one time said, as we looked at this list of things, competitive, high achieving, things like that. One person looked at the list and said, well, wait a minute. Those are all the things that make me really good as a lawyer. And we said, yeah, that's right. And the same thing in the being attuned to people's needs and caring about them, they are good things. And the cure is not to stop doing those things and not to stop using those skills. What we have to do is learn how to know what mode we're in and to you know, break out of sort of lawyer mindset. If we're in our heads and analytical all the time, we're not paying attention to our emotion. We're not paying attention to our relationships. That's the danger. So it's knowing when to use the very skills, the ways that we were made. Right. There's ways and times to be tuned into other people's needs, and empathetic is spot on what you got to do. You just can't do it forever. You can't only do that and never be recharging. It's kind of like a tank, basically, if you think about it. You can't just keep drawing out of your tank, spending all your fuel for other things and never doing anything to refill it.
Right. The tank or the bank, whatever it is, will be empty.
Call it tank, call it a bank. Yeah.
What some people might not realize, if to anyone who has even a basic level of understanding of codependency, is it's really a sliding scale. Right? It's a healthy only to a certain extent. And there's not a line in the sand where you cross that line and it's unhealthy. It really varies based on the situation, and the specific circumstances. And typically, like you said, you had to examine how you relate to your family, your friends, your coworkers, whatever.
Yeah.
When you have codependent tendencies or codependent behaviors, you relate to everybody in a codependent way. It's not like, oh, I'm codependent with my mom. Maybe that's where you're, you know, traits and behaviors of codependency were developed from, you know, unmet childhood wounds or whatever it might be, but you tend to relate to everybody in that way. It's, you know, just, you know, relate to certain people. So you really have to take the totality of your life and how you interact with others and kind of see where you fall on that sliding scale and adjust. I mean, codependency is a regular struggle for me. I've been in recovery, if you will, for about 5 years, but it's still something I have to actively work on. And I'm really glad that you drew attention to this, as well as, you know, the ADD that you mentioned, because I cannot tell you, and especially in my early days practicing as a lawyer, baby lawyer days, had a lot of colleagues that struggled with ADHD, and just as many that I felt, based on what you described in my basic understanding of it, that struggled with ADD, but undiagnosed ADD, that described the same things that you said, like very high functioning, very high performing, work great under a deadline. I mean, I've described myself this way. If I have 20 things to do in a day that all need to be done, I will most likely get all of those things done. But if I show up into the office and there's nothing in front of me, I mean, that almost never happens, but if there's nothing that has to be done that day, it'll take, or there's one thing to do, it'll take me all day to do that one thing.
Right. Well, and I think it's so awesome to have conversations like this. And truly, over the 10 plus years that I've been doing these programs, you know, the climate is definitely changing. It's becoming, I think, a little bit safer to admit our humanity, to admit that we don't get it all perfect. It was not that way when I started. It was kind of radical to suggest, hey, we should think about, you know, these things and not, again, the goal is not everybody's got something diagnosable or some, you know, horrible condition, DSM, you know, defined or anything like that. It's to recognize that we all are functioning on a continuum. My wife is a mental health counselor, and she likes to say, you know, look, the DSM and the actual those are just kind of labels for things, for human behavior, and you know, sometimes helpful as diagnostic criteria, to apply diagnostic criteria, to have a name for something, like you said earlier, can be helpful. Say, oh, there's a thing. It's not just I'm defective and only me. It's other people also deal with this, and the great part about that is A, not feeling as alone, because isolation is another thing that lawyers, I think, battle. We try to fix things by ourselves because, heck, we got to law school by ourselves. Typically, we got through it by ourselves. And there's a lot of independence, you know, in our profession that is touted, again, as a virtue. But recognizing that some things, if we are core to the problem, then we need resources outside us to move in a better direction. It's like if you want to lose weight or start running marathons or something, you know, lots of times you think to get a coach, somebody who's done it, who's been there. And the more we can do that in law and say, look, we are all human beings trying to navigate this and all these stresses between the job itself, particularly the adversary system and the way courts are set up and our families or our personal lives, whatever those look like, if we can be together honest about what's going on in those journeys, we have a lot of resources to point to, and it's getting safer, I think, for lawyers to acknowledge that. It's one of the side positive effects, if there is any, of COVID, not to make light of all the hard parts of COVID, but all of a sudden everybody's working from home on top of their kids, having to deal with technology. You know, some people had never, you know, dialed in remotely before and didn't ever want to, and now everybody's got to. it's made the, and some people had to say, hey, look, I can be on this call until three and then I got to unzoom my kids from school or whatever. It's helped with these conversations being more normal and more possible. We still have a ways to go, but at least, you know, it's we're not lurking in the shadows nearly as much, saying that, you know, some days are better than others.
I think not that might be the most important nugget that you've shared. And there's been quite a few, you know, in this time we've been talking. I had a therapist that told me, similar to what you just explained about your wife's practice, that, you know, we come up with these, you know, DSM conditions so that we can categorize people. But why? Why do we want to categorize them? Well, yes, so we know how to treat them, but also so that they have a community with each other. In the same way that, you know, you become pregnant with your first child and you might join a Facebook group, Mothers Do in July 2018 or whatever.
Yeah.
So that you can find people that are alone or with you in that same journey of life. And it's why, you know, we jump to, you know, if we have a child that is diagnosed with, God forbid, you know, a leukemia, then we join a support group for, you know, parents with children struggling with cancer. It's the exact same thing. But as lawyers, and I have three questions that I want to get to as we conclude this. But
sure.
As lawyers, why is it that our profession historically has pushed us into isolation and taught us not to talk about it? What is your opinion as to why historically that has been the basis
that,
of...
Yeah. That's a great question. And I love that question. I have done a lot of thinking about it and I need to probably like write this up. I think it's a combination of one, lawyers, how we're portrayed in media and in the common culture's understanding. So there's, you know, Atticus Finch, the superstar lawyer, or, you know, somebody from Law and Order giving the wonderful summation in, you know, 60 seconds that devastates everything. It's this sort of, there's this image, number one, that because people bring us their problems and we become their champions, we have to be, you know, like the superhero kind of automaton, sort of, you know, Energizer Bunny, pick your metaphor. A second factor is we have always emphasized when you join the bar, and I'm not sure how long, I think these requirements have been around from the start, but every state bar pretty much requires, quote unquote, a character and fitness examination. Okay. And there's a good side in that we're trying to, you know, have some gatekeeping, on the front side when somebody passes the bar and they want to become a lawyer. If they are, let's say they were, you know, a person with sociopathic, you know, behavioral tendencies or something, that we want to be alert to that. We sort of, I guess, I think set ourselves up, but I'm not sure how many other professions do that. But we have to sort of say, oh, you know, if you're going to be a lawyer, you got to be a moral, upstanding, fit person. Mm-hmm. The problem is, I think we've taken, and there's a campaign underway to kind of either remove that or change how it operates in multiple states, because it's got, you know, law students who are graduating are afraid of that kind of, well, I'm going to have to disclose it. And so a lot of people don't go get help because they're afraid that disclosing, oh, I have a psychiatrist, I've seen a psychiatrist, is going to be held against them because they're going to say, oh, you have some kind of mental illness if you've been to a psychiatrist. We can't let you be a lawyer. And the PR around that has been terrible. And what it needs to be, you know, because the other thing is that's super messed up about that is somebody who actually is self-aware enough and has dealt with stuff enough at the age of, you know, 23, 24, when they're going to law school, to have gotten care from the outside and they're leaning into it and they're saying, yeah, I have, you know, I have ADD, I have OCD, I have dyslexia, whatever kind of thing it is. That's awesome. That's somebody who's aware of their problem and dealing with it. And that's way better actually than a ticking time bomb of somebody who's bopping through and thinking they're fine. And people around them might say, I'm not so sure you are. And so I think some of it is the character and fitness exam scares people. And we have this sort of warped notion of you must be some excellent type of person beyond the average to be a lawyer.
Yeah,
I think
human.
That's mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So I think it's partly that, and it's partly the last ingredient I'll say is because ours is a public profession, at least with regard to litigation attorneys. Not so much, it doesn't come into play with transactional attorneys, but the courtroom lawyer is perceived as, you know, somebody who's either, you know, summing up for the jury, cross-examining. We have so many images in our head from TV and movies many of them not accurate or on point, that it's, you know, if you're this champion, if somebody is vesting you with the opportunity to save the day and you know, win their case, then you got to be this, again, special human, you know, Avenger type person. And so it's a combination of those things.
I think that that's
And then the last thing I'll say is this. The other last thing is, I thought of one other. Status, we are driven by sometimes too much externals. For example, I went to a great top 10 law school, loved it, and I'm glad I got to go there. It's a privilege. But I, at the time, put way too much stock in what law school I went to and what law schools I didn't go to, as if that made so much difference in what kind of lawyer I was going to be. Mm-hmm. I now see that as absolute poppycock, nonsense. There are great lawyers who went to all different kinds of law schools. There are some lawyers churned out by the supposed top 10 law schools who aren't that good. I mean, it's not, that's not a determinative factor, but we are so status driven. We're so, did you make law review? Did you do this? Did you go to a T14 school or a top 20 school? And we put a lot, and I don't know many other professions that have as much boasting about profits per partner and some of the stuff that we write about. It's kind of silly, but we're very image conscious. And I think more so than a lot of professions.
I agree with you.
Yeah. So anyway, that's my rant.
So with that, what can we do to make it better? I mean, what would be your suggestions for the profession? Obviously, you're doing a lot of work with, with real-time CLE, creative learning experiences. What, as a profession, can we do?
Yeah. So a couple things. One is, podcasts like this, so a lot of the conversations that I know you've been ginning up or been part of on LinkedIn, where people are declaring, hey, look, this is the kind of things that I deal with, and I'm still a doggone good lawyer. I think we the more we can keep telling the right kinds of stories, not look at me, the hero, I saved the day, and everything I do just, you know, floats around on clouds and beauty, and my excrement does not reek of odor, the kind of attitude, if we can dispel that sort of attitude and have more conversations with our peers, colleagues, people we trust about, look, these are the things I'm juggling, I'm struggling with, I navigate, I will do a great job as a lawyer, and I've got to not always be in that mode. I've got to, take time for my family, take time for my mental health, take time for my physical health. Normalize those kind of conversations. I think that's huge, because the more people who realize, I've never had anybody come up to us after a presentation and say, I don't get it. You guys are all these defective people, and y'all suck, but I'm great. Nobody comes up and says that. If they did, I'd punch them. But everybody comes up and says, oh, thank you. Thank you for talking about this. I thought I was the only one. I thought everybody else. In fact, I did a program one time for the Mecklenburg County Bar, and we've done it so much real time, called Maybe I'm Not Just Messy. And it was about practicing law and thriving with ADD. I remember when I would go to other lawyers' offices and they were all neat and pristine and everything was, looked great. Of course, it probably had been cleaned up for me to be there. I don't know. But I know I felt defective. I felt less. I'm like, my office doesn't look like that. It's chaos. It's got too many papers and I'm not sure where everything is. To recognize that you're not the only person. I'm thankful for that colleague. I'll give him a shout out, John Bowers at my old law firm, who said, hey, man, you seem like you're dealing with the same thing I am. And this has been helpful to me. I wonder if you want to consider it. That took guts for him to admit it. It took a lot for me to listen and go, he's a good lawyer. He's not a bad lawyer at all, but he's got these challenges. And we would do that if somebody comes in and they're, we see a physical, limitation they have, like they're paraplegic or they only have one arm or something. We're going to know, oh, they can still be a great lawyer and they're just going to have challenges that I don't have. Well, it's the same way with these cognitive things. And so I think having the conversation, the other thing that we really try to emphasize a lot is don't try to fix it alone. Don't go it alone. Have peers, have colleagues, even if they're outside your organization. If everybody in your organization is really not receptive to weakness or honesty, find somebody somewhere else that you can talk about with, commiserate with, and maybe, eventually, you might need to work somewhere different if you don't have support. More and more law firms that we're talking to.
That's largely the impetus behind this series is, first of all, you said, don't fix it alone, don't go it alone. Like, You are not alone, right? So that's what I want to do, is and bring to attention everyday lawyers, you know, like you and I, that have had various struggles, so that other people know the same. I think that's so critical. And on that, if there was someone that was struggling, you know, with one of the things that you mentioned, the ADD or the codependency, or maybe something else altogether, like what's advice that you would give, or something helpful that could have been told to you, you know, at that, the height of your struggles in your career,
sure,
that would have been helpful.
Yeah, I would say, number one, the importance of just, you know, the counseling is so much more accessible. It's so much more affordable. It's so much less stigmatized. I like the word counseling over my colleague describes himself sometimes as a therapist. He actually works for the Lawyer Assistance Program of British Columbia a couple days a week, and he, you know, counsels or coaches lawyers. But I'd say find a counselor or coach, somebody to talk to. It's completely private. They may talk to you and say, you know what, you're actually good. There's nothing I can do for you. And then great, you have, you know, that affirmation, and you can maybe, you know, go on and figure out life on your own. Or they'll say, hey, you're not the first person I've talked to about this. Tell me more about it. Let me hear about it. No judgment, no criticism, but maybe I can help you, you know, get a tune up and get things functioning better. So finding good help, professionally, potentially, and not being afraid of that. It's not, you don't have to go right to a psychologist, a psychiatrist. Yeah. There's degrees of this. And then your lawyer assistance program. Mm-hmm. Yes. And one way to find the community is the lawyer assistance program in almost every state. In some states, it's lawyers helping lawyers or lawyers concerned for lawyers. There may be a different name, but your state bar probably has something. And they are not just crisis response. Like, you only deal with them if you are an addict going off the rails and you are defalcating, is the word, you know, your practice has to be taken over because you've, you know, just gotten so sloppy drunk all the time that you can't do anything. That's not, they're not the place of last resort. They do get involved in situations like that, but they'd much rather hear from you when you're just dealing with stress, when you're just dealing with work-life integration and dissatisfaction. So I would say, you know, reach out to your LAP or lawyers concerned with lawyers. You can call us at Real Time. Michael is actually, we're about to start some group coaching, some groups that'll be either focused on particular struggles, like we might have one for ADD people, if I can remember to put it on my calendar and schedule it, make that happen. Exactly. See what I did there. And then we, you know, grief. Lots of people are motoring along doing fine, and then they lose a spouse or a child or a parent unexpectedly, and it messes with your system, and you got to do something with that grief, and you got to have a place to process it. And so we're going to have kind of some grief groups, things like that, opportunities for people, again, to be in things together, to get some outside guidance from somebody who's basically not you. The best qualification anybody has to be able to help any of us is that they're outside our head and they're not just doing the same old loops. And so speak out, find somebody, reach out. There are people. I've not heard anything yet that anybody shared in a conference or sent us in a confidential email or called and said, there's nothing I've heard and said, oh, wait, that's too messed up. Forget it. Get out of here. You're really freaked. You know, you just, there's no reason to fear that at all. Everybody's got their stuff, and you will find kindred spirits and resources for that journey. And so so lean into some kind of community, lean into some kind of help, tell a friend, even if they're not a lawyer. If you're afraid of what lawyers are going to think, then tell a friend who's not a lawyer. But find somebody, and I promise you, you know, it's scary, but you'll find somebody who eventually is going to say, hey man, me too. I've been there. And here's hope. There's a way to deal with this and not just let it keep, you know, taking the
I echo that advice. I echo that. I would hope that anybody listening today, whatever it is that you may be going through, or even if it's not you, but, you know, someone in your family or a coworker, that you hear the encouraging words of community and fellowship with other humans, because at the end of the day, you know, I don't just say the struggle is real because it's the title of the series, but we do all struggle,
right?
And there's no need to be alone. Chris, how can...
And there's no shame in struggle. Struggle is a word that there's no shame in. Everybody experiences it in some form or fashion. And if we can talk about it that way...
I can sit here and talk for 2 days about shame, too.
Exactly. That's a whole other thing. Gosh, and lawyers are, you know, again, we've got some challenges there because sometimes we operate And we traffic in shame, and we try to shame other people into doing other stuff. But shame isn't the great motivator to really bring about real change. Blame and shame are two of our frequently used tools in the legal profession. They suck in interpersonal relationships. They don't really work well, but they have a very strong appeal. And so finding ways to look for commonalities and ways that we can lift one another up, that's a lot more productive.
I agree. Chris, the Legal Wolf podcast listeners are all around the globe. How can they get in touch with you if they're interested in real-time creative learning experiences for educational purposes or working with you as a coach or whatever else? How can they reach you?
Sure. We have a website, www.realtime, CLE. We probably should have specified from the beginning, realtime is spelled R-E-E-L, like a film reel or a fishing reel, because, we started with the movies as our kind of means of opening up conversations. We've actually shot some of our original films to really try to make things less Hollywood and over the top. But realtime.cle.com, and you can email me at chris@realtimecle.com. My colleague, who's the actual counselor, coach, therapist, is Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, at realtime, R-E-E-L-T-I-M-E-C-L-E.com. Those are easiest ways to get up with us. Stay tuned with also, we also have a podcast, which, Chris, I've already invited you to be on, and I'm going to make sure that we go and set up a time for you to be on, because I want to ask the questions next time. a little cross promotion here, but the Thriving Lawyers podcast, and that's thriving like thriving, not just surviving, but Thriving Lawyers with an S, podcast.com. We usually have conversations with real humans who are practicing law, all kinds of settings, in-house counsel, litigators, transactional lawyers, all sharing their journeys kind of like this of, hey, what is it meant for you to thrive as a lawyer? What does it take for you to thrive as a lawyer? I love your question, Christoph. You know, what would you want to do different, or what now, having learned what you've learned, what would you share with other people? We love that kind of conversation. So we're going to have fun, have you on there for sure. I want to talk with Mr. Lawler as well, maybe get to know more about, I love this, you know, what we're learning about the Legal Wolf podcast. I hope we'll be able to cross-pollinate a little bit towards a great end.
Yeah, I hope so. So thank you. Now they know how to reach you. I know that Steve and the work that he is doing with Legal Wolf, not just here on the podcast, but globally, with having changing the conversation among mental health in the legal profession, and just understanding what mental health law is in different countries around the globe is really making a huge difference. Again, from one human lawyer to another, thank you for joining and sharing your struggle. And I can't wait to talk soon. Thanks so much, Chris.
Sounds great. Krista, thank you so much. This has been a delight.
All right.